Now I would like to talk about some topics about this bulk excitations of invertible phases. And this is based on an upcoming work with David Stephen from University of Colorado Boulder, and also Professor Xie Chen from Caltech. And hopefully the paper will come out in a couple of weeks. Bulk excitations of invertible phases sounds a very general like topic. But we will talk about it through our context. Especially, I would like to first generalize the excitations to include as well as those higher dimensional to excitations to higher dimensions as well as defects, and specifically to include all of them. I'd like to give a definition, especially using quantum circuits, so we can do everything very concretely on the lattice. And then just by consider these kind of generic excitations, and we'll propose our result, which states that bulk excitations in invertible phases and those in a product state always have a one-to-one correspondence. And I'll show you through some examples that's already like easy to see, such as this SPT phases within the cohomology class and the Gitaev chain. And such phases, they're simple enough that previous argument using quantum cellular automaton argument already works. But there are also other phases that this argument doesn't work. And then the main part of this talk is to give our argument using the symmetry TFT construction, which will include more examples than the QCA argument. So let me get started. So nowadays, this higher dimensional excitations, and it's already like known to be appearing everywhere, and they play a very important role in characterizing many of the quantum phases matter. For example, in this Ising ferromagnetic phase, like defining excitations is this domain wall excitations, and that is a one-dimensional excitation. And then in G gauge series in generic dimensions, we are always essential to include this flux loop excitation, which is a one-dimensional excitations. It has a mutual braiding state with point particles. And even in some more exotic phases, you can define some braiding process that only involves loops. So we have to include them to distinguish different quantum phases matters. But as a lattice person, let's step back and see how we normally think of them. So first of all, how we usually generate them. When we describe such kind of excitations, we have usually two ways to describe it. One is we can modify the Hamiltonian. Let's say in this Ising ferromagnetic, we start with a Hamiltonian that's pretty homomorphic, homogeneous, and then just change some coupling terms in the Hamiltonians along this loop. Then this is how we insert excitations. And then another way to define this excitations is to try to find unitary operators, then use it to act on the ground state. For example, this Ising domain wall, we can apply this product of X operator within this range, and then it will create it.
So is there a difference between the word excitation and defect for you? Are you going to use them interchangeably, or are they defined?
That's what I'm getting at. Like, there are many properties that defects also shares with excitations, so I want to propose unified definitions to include all of them.
I see. So would you call something an excitation if it arises by this by modifying the Hamiltonian?
Many of the excitations we already defined by modifying the Hamiltonian. Like anion, one of the definitions of anion is you change the Hamiltonian local terms locally, so you can like create an anion, and then it's a topological excitation because you cannot use any local unitary operators to remove it.
Sure, but I think a lot of people, I would define that as a defect, not an excitation.
An anion?
No, this way of having a non-dynamical anion just sitting there. It's like equivalent to like threading like a time like defect in space time.
Okay, after the brief discussion in the audience, we all agree that it's hard to. And there are more features that they share similarities. And first, like, they're actually not necessarily the energy eigenstates of your Hamiltonians. Say you perturb your Hamiltonian from slightly away from fixed point, those kind of like excitation can, like, after a while, it will decay and resolve. And of course, its dynamics is also interesting. So in general, it's good enough if it can maintain this form for a finite amount of time, so it could, like, consider it as some kind of excitations. And a key point is that since it's like all these excitations, in one way, you can define them by modifying the Hamiltonian. And the modified Hamiltonian is still have a gap. So these kind of excitations, they always have area law entanglement. So the low entanglement property is preserved. And as we said, that many of these properties is already shared by defects. And for example, this is one of popular defects. This is the EM exchange defect in toric code. First of all, we can define it by modifying the Hamiltonians, like you insert some lattice screwing. And then you can also find a unitary operator that acts on the toric code ground state to create it. And that's what Xie Shen and her previous collaborator does. They found a quantum circuit that can insert this EM exchange defect. And of course, then you can, respect to the original Hamiltonian, apparently this defects inserted by unitary will no longer be energy eigenstate. Nevertheless, this quantum circuit cannot be a finite depth local unitaries. So there's no finite depth local unit that can remove these defects. That's why, so if this defect, once you insert it under the original Hamiltonian, it still can remain its form for some amount of time. And it also has a low entanglement. So with that, we want to, like instead of focusing on the difference between defects and excitations, let's try to see, focus on their similarities and try to give unified definitions for excitations and defects. And especially, we want to keep track of those that always have low entanglements. So now let me give you our definition to unify them. So we would like to use the quantum circuit to not only create this k-dimensional excitations, but also to define its key properties. So a k-dimensional excitations on top of a ground state of a gapped Hamiltonian in d dimensions, first of all, we'd like to consider only those that can be the gapped ground state of Hamiltonian, which the Hamiltonian local terms is only modified along the excitations. So this way, we declare what's the dimension of this excitations. And this modified Hamiltonian already also has to be gapped. So then these excitations is already low, has low entanglement. And then we define if two excitation, they're equivalent. If they are related by finite depth local unitary, then within a short amount of time, they can like transform from one to another. So they're equivalent types. And with that, then the trivial types apparently will be out of those that generate from the bulk ground state by a k-dimensional finite depth local unitary. And then the non-trivial ones will be those that cannot generated by k-dimensional finite depth local unitary. Nevertheless, they can still be generated by, for example, k plus one dimensional quantum circuit or a k-dimensional circuit that's not finite depth, but linear depth. And the particular one is this sequential circuit where in each step you only have a local gates. So each step you preserve the low entanglement. In the end, even though it's a linear depth circuit, it still preserves the entanglement area law. So this definition, it looks very new, but actually it captures all the previous excitations and defects we know. For example, there's some simple examples like this domain wall. Apparently, you can modify the Hamiltonians along the loop, so it should be a one-dimensional excitation. And indeed, the circuit that generates is this product X within this patch, so it's a 2D finite depth local unitary. And then this flux loop is also a 1D excitation in the 3D bulk. And then you can also, it's also generated by a two-dimensional finite depth local unitary. And it's this EM exchange defect, as I said, you can modify the Hamiltonian along a line. Sorry, not a loop, just a line, can have endpoint. And it's still a one-dimensional excitations, and it has to be generated by a 1D sequential circuit rather than a 1D finite depth local unitary.
Excuse me, a question. So the sequential circuit is when the depth grows linearly along with the depth. What's special about linear growth? Why can't it grow faster than linear?
Oh, you can grow faster, but
it's a special situation.
It's just linear is enough for us to generate it. We just
so
want to keep.
Like maybe it doesn't detect community.
Right.
It's sequential, but you can generate faster growth.
Yeah, but yeah, that's also work as long as it keeps the low, entanglement low. But so far, for the, all the examples we found, like sequential one, is already works. And then with that definition, now we can like consider like in a box state in d dimensional, all the we can count all the excitations of different dimensions. And then, for example, there's one interesting one. You can have like you start with a 2D symmetric state that essentially just a product state, but you impose a symmetry on top of it. And then on this trivial product state, you can generate a very non-trivial one-dimensional excitations. In fact, there's a sequential circuit that can generate this one-dimensional GHZ state, which is a representative state of symmetry breaking phase. And by our definition, it's also a one-dimensional excitations. And if you're interested, this is the circuit that generated. So using this definition, we can sort out all the possible excitations given ambient phase. And for example, this Z2 symmetric phase in 2D, there's only one non-trivial type of zero-dimensional excitations. That's the Z2 charge. It's generated by this one-dimensional finite depth local unitary. And there's only one type of non-trivial 1D excitations that's the symmetry breaking phase generated by a sequential circuit.
Can I have a question?
Yes, so if we go back to the previous slide and look at the definition, on the lattice, if I consider the isomorphic magnet, if I consider the domain wall of this size and the domain wall with a much larger size, do you say they're equivalent?
If you have two, sorry, two of them?
I'm asking whether they are equivalent on the
basis. Yeah, they should be equivalent.
What's the FDLU connect? What's the one dimensional FDLU connect?
I don't know in the top of my head, but that's not.
With this definition, do we sort of want to fix the region in which the Hamiltonian is modified, or do we sort of consider all such regions?
No, with this definition, we always start, so it can be generated two ways. You can be generated by modify your Hamiltonians along some submanifold, and also it can also be generated from a bulk ground state by a unitary operator.
Yeah, I guess there's lots of questions. Like, for example,
suppose you have a defect and another rotative defect. So why are they in the same phase again? So since it's rotated, you cannot really move. You cannot do rotation by finite depth circles.
Maybe in 2D you have a small domain wall, a large domain wall. Is there a finite depth local unitary that you can go from this small domain wall to a large domain wall?
I think it's just easier to think about straight ones, but for straight ones in the dimension higher than one can rotate things. then
those should not be, because lattice theories just should maybe have an emergent Lorentz symmetry, but that's something emergent. Like there's no reason for the lattice to be able to rotate its own.
No, but the lattice has a discrete rotational symmetry.
But that's there's no reason that you should be able to do that.
The point is, whatever definitions you make mathematically, you would like to have this feature that
I'm saying I would not like the feature that.
Okay, we could just say we got another equivalent rotation.
Yeah,
there's no reason why. Yeah. It seems like there's no. In some cases, it should be. So some.
Yeah, but that should be a theorem, not a definition.
If you establish an equivalent between the system and the rotated system as the same phase, then after you do that, you should be able to compare the difference. But you shouldn't be able to compare rotated defects in the same system without proving first the system can be checked.
Yeah.
So in this definition, you have an equivalent between two phases first, and then discuss when the difference in two phases are equivalent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a definition of phases is the same issue. It's never clear why. Actually, I don't know any situation where you actually prove that the rotation of a phase is also a discrete one, like 90 degrees. It's actually the same as the original one.
Can I ask maybe? So if I took this definition and I'm just thinking about, you know, making a pair of like E particles in the Torah code and they're far apart, right? So that's like a depth one circuit.
Sorry, I was still thinking about the previous question.
Oh, sorry.
I think
okay.
I think that involves like deformation of the defects, and then usually deformation of the defect can be related by some finite depth local unitaries. So this is not like discussed in this definition I give. That it's like the further properties. Then yeah, we have a. Like following definition, how do you deform defects from one places to another? It's connected by finite depth local unitary.
So just so I understand, like what this classification is telling me. So I guess I'm thinking about, you know, the Torah code. I make a pair of E's. So you know that's just a depth one circuit, right? No matter how, you know, however far apart they are. And you know, but then you know, maybe if I wanted to make some more complicated pair of like far separated non-abelian anions, then you know, maybe it takes a longer circuit. So, is that like in this classification? Are you somehow thinking about like a pair of E's?
Yeah, that's very good. That's in this classification. So the non-abelian anions, first of all, you can modify the Hamiltonian only locally around the anions. So it should, if it's non-trivial, it at most it's zero-dimensional excitations. But it can only generate it by a one-dimensional sequential circuit rather than one-dimensional finite depth local unitary. But it's still a circuit, so it's captured by this definition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the abelian anions are somehow trivial?
No, abelian anion is also non-trivial zero-dimensional excitations, since it cannot be created locally by a zero-dimensional unitary operator. It has also been created by one-dimensional finite depth local unitary.
So when you say things related by finite depth local unitaries are equivalent, that's like with respect to the dimension of the defect.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. That's what I thought.
Okay, so after we accept this way of generating all the excitations, then we have like easy to work out this excitations in and starting with an unentangled product state. Then we can ask, what about an entangled ground state? And then this I want to claim in this talk is that if we only consider such kind of excitations in an invertible phases, then all these kind of low entanglement excitations, they have a one-to-one correspondence to those in a product state. For many of the simple examples, this is already easy to show. So let's say some simple SPT state with some finite symmetries. Then we already know there's some unitary operators that's called this SPT entangler or disentangler. It is a finite depth local unitary that's overall commute with the symmetry. Then any symmetric operators in a trivial product state, all with the supports in the k dimension, after this finite depth local unitary, which will always be mapped to another symmetric operators that still has the support of k dimensions. And then it means that there's a one-to-one correspondence between symmetric operators in a trivial product state and those in an SPT state. So then this low entanglement excitations, they are also, it's a subset of this symmetric operators. That's why there's a one-to-one correspondence. And then another example we already know is this one-dimensional Kitaev chain. It is also an invertible phase which has a fermion parity symmetry. Now we don't have any finite depth local unitary as before, but still there's a locality preserving unitaries. And you just translate the Majorana fermions by one side. And then you can map from the trivial superconductor to this 1D Kitaev chain state. And usually this is also called a non-trivial quantum cellular automaton. And basically all the states that can be related by such kind of quantum cellular automata, you can argue that their excitations as we defined has a one-to-one correspondence. But there are some examples that go beyond this quantum cellular automata be able to connect. For example, this P plus IP superconductors. So far, there's no QCA that can pump it, can create it. So then this goes to the main part of my talk. That's I want to give you an argument using this symmetry TFT constructions. And it actually works for all the previous examples. And it's an independent argument from the QCA.
For the fermionic system, since the degrees of freedom is fractionalized, is there also a notion of, I don't know, quantum cellular automaton? This is not a very well-defined question. For the fermionic system with fractionalized degrees of freedom, is there also a definition of quantum cellular automaton?
What do you mean fractionalized degree? Majoranas?
This is Majorana chain. Right? You are translating one Majorana mode. So you are not mapping the local Hilbert space to local Hilbert space.
This is a well-defined QCA, and also like for this context, you can just write my runners back in the complex fermions, and then all the operators you first figure out how to translate in terms in the representation of my runners, and then you can translate back to the complex fermions, and still the like the locality of the operators doesn't change.
I see. Yes.
What happens in the invertible phase?
Invertible, non-trivial invertible phase is like those, has a single ground state, and if you impose symmetries, it cannot be go back to the original state, go back to a trivial product state. Like it includes the most common short-range entangled state as well as some long-range entangled state, but with a single ground state. Like integer quantum hall, let's say.
But that's kind of a bit vague. So Kitaev has a like different definition involving preparing state together with some partner from a trivial state by a circuit. What's is it?
I also require that invert. You can also have an inverse of it. So when you stack, it trivialize.
Okay, so this would be a good definition. Right?
Yeah, that's part of the.
Isn't it enough?
That's enough for invertible state, but we want to consider, when I say I implicitly mean some non-trivial invertible phase.
I'm thinking just invertible phase would be something which can get along with some partner, disentangled partner, by starting with a trivial phase and then applying a circuit. That's what Kitaev's definition, right? You're okay with that, right?
Yeah.
And the trivial is simply the one which is invertible plus can be just disentangled with the circuit on its own.
Uh-huh.
So you don't need anything else. Right? I would be happy with it.
I'm happy with it, but I would say it's.
Do you impose anything else apart from that?
I don't impose anything else, but I would say this argument, since it's used symmetry TFT, so far it works only for like finite symmetries and such kind of things. So for IQH, such kind of state, it doesn't work. So.
But you're going to use some other definition. I'm going to relate symmetry TFT to this definition?
Maybe I should say. Those invertible phases that realizable by the symmetry TFT construction.
Okay. You're just going to assume that there is symmetry.
Yeah. Okay, then this argument has a couple of steps. So let me first outline it. So step one, we're going to compare boundaries of topological orders. And we will start with one boundary conditions and then twist it and then describe their similarities and differences. And then use this kind of boundary conditions and its twisted versions. We can go to step two to try to use them to construct invertible phases using this sandwich construction. And then we're going to say that they were going to reduce to different but quite related invertible phases. And that led us to be able to compare the excitations. So step one, let's talk about the boundaries of topological orders. And so this is already familiar with this audience. So let's start with an example. This is, we have started with two copies of 2D toric codes. And apparently there's one type of gapped boundaries where this all this M particle the vertex all condensed on the boundary. And then there's another boundary conditions. You can condense the type 1 vertex bind with the type 2 charge, as well as the type 2 vertex bound with type 1 charge. This is also a this is also a Lagrangian algebra, so you can condense them and get gapped boundaries. Now we ask, how do you get from this state from the right, toric code with a specific boundary to the left, toric code with another another boundary? And in fact, there's a 2D finite depth local unit tree can map the right the system from on the right to the left. So just by applying a 2D finite depth local unit tree, you can get from right to the left. And this is possible because these anions share some exchange symmetries. So if take excitations in the two copies of toric code, and there's exchange symmetry that you map the M1 to M1E2 and M2 to M2E1, and then the bulk toric code is remains the same. So this means that you can have a one-dimensional line defect. That through this line defect, that it acts as this anion exchange symmetry. Then by sweeping this one-dimensional defect, you actually act as a global symmetry operation on this toric code. It's a symmetry because the bulk toric code is invariant. So this U generates a Z2 emergent symmetry on the bulk toric code. Nevertheless, when your toric code has a boundary, it does something non-trivial to the boundary terms. Especially, it will map those kind of rough boundary to boundary terms to this twisted rough boundary terms. So this picture shows that this after this unitary operators, the bulk is invariant. The Hamiltonian local terms doesn't change at all. Only the boundary terms change. So then, through this unitary, you get from the right and to the left. Now, because these two states are related by a finite depth local unitary, I want to claim that there's no experiments you can do near the boundary that can tell you which particular type of boundary you are. Because whatever experiments you do, you're represented by some operators near the boundary, say with the support of K dimension, just near the boundary. Then you can always use this finite depth local unitary to find another operators near the other type of boundary. That's whatever experiment results you get, these two are the same. And the support of these operators is also the same. So there's one-to-one correspondence between experiments you can do. That's why if you only can give you one boundary, you will not tell which one it is. So we call this, there's no absolute distinction between these two types of boundaries. Nevertheless, this is apparently two different type of boundaries. we will know they're different when we put them together. So if you have a single block with two copies of target code, but on the boundary, one half is this M condensed one, on the other half is this twist M condensed one, then the claim is that there's always a non-trivial domain wall at the junction. This non-trivial domain wall can never be removed by any local unitary operators. This is because there's some degenerate states encoded in this domain wall. So the standard argument is that if you create, say, a target code with several segments of boundary conditions that's alternating between the M condensed one and the twisted M condensed one, then you can always find some non-local string operators that go across your block that, since they anti-commute, they will act as logical operators on the ground state subspace. That suggests that the ground state has always is degenerate, and this degenerate can never be lifted. And if you only apply local unitary operators, like localized near these junctions, you can never remove this degeneracy. That's why any local unitary operators can never remove this domain wall. So in summary, like the step is like we can always start with one type of boundary conditions, and by sweeping an invertible line defect, we can obtain an emergent symmetry of the topological order. And this kind of emergent symmetry associated with invertible defects is always generated by a finite depth local unitary. And it does the trivial things in the block, but it changed the boundary types. Nevertheless, this boundary types can only be distinguished relatively. So colloquially speaking, it's boundary conditions related by the block finite depth local unitary. They are twins. You cannot distinguish them if you only have one of them, but you can distinguish them if they put together. So this is an example based on this anion exchange symmetry, but there's also many examples in higher dimensions. For example, in three dimensions, let's consider the bulk is a three-dimensional toric code. And you can let this flux loop to condense on the boundary. This is what's the generalization of the smooth boundary. And then there's a surface defect that you can sweep. That's called this gauge Z2 SPT defect. And it's generated by a 3D finite depth local unitary. And you can show that in this way, the bulk remains the same, but the boundary terms is also modified. So in this way, you get a twisted boundary condition. And the same argument goes through that there's no absolute way to distinguish them. But if you put them as together, then there's a way to tell. For example, you can consider like this kind of 3D block. The left half has the untwisted boundary. The right half has a twisted boundary. Then let's create a flux loop in the block and bring it to the boundary. And bring it to the boundary. Then those that hit the boundary are going to condense. So this you are left with an open string of this flux. And it has two endpoints. And then you can consider this string that's cross this one-dimensional domain wall. Then one way to detect the distinction is like you perform this kind of analogous of like the three-loop braiding process. So you take one of the arc and then shrink it to go through the another arc and going back. And because the boundary is twisted, essentially, since this orange region is some kind of gauged Z2 SPT defect. The topological action is like some one-half ADA terms. So secretly, this endpoint have some sort of semionic statistics. That's why through this braiding process, you actually get a minus one sign.
Oh, is that red line gapped?
Yeah, it's gapped. The E is condensed on it.
Oh.
why is this only a relative distinction? Because in a gauge density boundary, I can just measure the spin of the excitations and they should be semions.
Yeah, actually, you cannot really measure it. Whatever, say some, you create some loops and try to measure it by some operators, and through this finite depth local unitary, you can cook up another operators, which are probably not your familiar ones, but they all do the same job as give you a minus one phase.
I'm sorry. This orange thing, doesn't it also extend into the bulk?
No, only the boundary term is modified on top of this surface.
Okay, I thought you said there's a sweeping some defect through the 3D.
That's the way you can know what kind of twisted boundary terms you can get. After you get it, you keep your bulk the same, but just, yeah.
Can I think of this as just taking a sort of 2D phase of the gap boundary and kind of putting it on top?
Yeah, and then you need to condense some pair of bosons to couple the two. Mm-hmm.
Do you know in this case what 2D phase I'm putting on top of my 3D?
A double semion, and then you condense. Yeah.
Can I ask another question about the last slide? If you do the statistics, is there some kind of like cancellation of spurious phases that you need to do? Like for instance, when you do exchange statistics, you have to like cancel by this T junction thing.
Oh yes, to properly define you do, but the claim is the way, however you define this is not removable. Yeah. Rather, if you have a single boundary condition, actually that's always kind of removable. And these are always only involve some loops that's braid, so it's allowed in a toric code. In 3D gauge theory. And then there's also some other interesting examples. For example, you can consider the bulk to be a 3D fermionic toric coat. Fermionic toric coat is pretty much similar to a boson toric coat, but the gauge charge now is a fermion. And then we also consider this flux loop condensed boundary. And then the one interesting vertical surface defects in this topological order is this so-called P plus IP defect. And recently it's being shown by these two gentlemen that there's a 3D finite depth quasi-local unitaries that can create pump this defect. And then if you sweep this defect through the whole bulk, then the bulk remains the same, but the boundary condition is also twisted. And the same argument also goes through. There's no absolute distinction between the two. Nevertheless, if you put them together, you will always have a chiral mode in between because this kind of flux loop, when it has endpoint, one of the endpoints carries a Majorana mode, but the total Majorana mode, but the total quantum dimension is integer. So there must be another Majorana mode that goes into this domain walls. And this also means that the domain wall is non-trivial and cannot be removed by any one-dimensional finite depth local unitary.
So I have a question. So can I generally think of the difference? Can I think of the difference as follows? I kind of ungauge the bulk, and if I just gauge it normally, I get the left. But or I could stack an invertible phase on the boundary and then gauge it the same way, and I get the right. Are all of these like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so the step one tells us that we can always start with the topological order with some boundary, and then by utilizing the emergent symmetries in the topological order, we can find a finite depth local unitary that gives you a topological order with another boundary condition, and these two are always only relatively distinguishable. Then we can use this to go through the sandwich construction and use them to construct the invertible phases. So actually, I think the talk in this morning already has some review about what do we mean by a symmetry TFT construction. Let me just quickly say it in a few words. And first, like, it's roughly saying that once you have a topological order and you have some boundaries, then this boundary system is equivalent to the symmetric sector of a D minus one dimensional system that has a global symmetry. And then the explicit way to turn this D-dimensional system into a purely D minus one dimensional system is this sandwich construction. So you have a box with two boundary conditions. And the top one, you can pick a gap, any gap boundary condition you want. And then that declares what's global symmetry you care about. And then you have a free boundary, like dynamical boundary conditions on the bottom. And because you pick a gapped boundary on the top, then such kind of short string operators, it's actually become a quasi-local operators in the D minus one dimensional systems. For example, in this example, once the toric code has the E condensed boundary on the top, then this short string of each E particle, it's actually us the squashing, it creates a Z2 symmetry charge. That's why after the squashing, you have a 1D system with a Z2 symmetry. And because, let's say, if you put the pick the bottom boundary to be the M condensed one, then this single E particle is a gapped excitations in this quasi 1D system. So it means that the Z2 charge is not condensed. That's why you're obtained a Z2 symmetric phase. Of course, if you choose the bottom boundary to be E-condensed, you'll get a Z2 symmetry breaking phase. Then let's use this construction to go through our previous examples. For example, if the box is this two copy of toric codes, which is a naive generalizations of my previous examples, then apparently you will get, after you do the squashing, you'll get a 1D system with a Z2 times Z2 symmetry and a symmetric phase under the symmetry. Now, let's change the bottom boundary condition to this twisted M-condensed boundary. And then, since the Z2 charges, they are all still gap excitations, none of them is condensed by themselves, you are guaranteed to have a 1D phase, still have the Z2 symmetry. And but you know that this phase must be different from this left constructions. So you're left with a single choice, that's the SPT phase in 1D. And because this left and right is related by this finite depth local unitary, so we know that all the symmetric operators you can get from the left, you can always get a corresponding one on the right. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the symmetric operators. And in particular, those low entanglement excitations, it's a subset of those symmetric operators. So they have a one-to-one correspondence all the time. So this means that if I handle you two SPT states, if you only use Hamiltonian terms and symmetric operators, if you only allow those operators, you can never tell which phase you are, a trivial one or a non-trivial one. You have to rather to be in reference to some other state, either put them together or take some state as a reference state. And then, so as I said, the non-trivial examples produced from this argument is this P plus IP superconductance. So how to get that using the sandwich? So we'll take this 3D fermion toric code, but the top, we will put this fermion condensed boundary. As the talk suggested by this morning, that you actually allow that, physically you are allowed to do that. You can, or you are always allowed to allow physical fermions in your system, and then you can condense your quasi-particle fermion together with the physical fermion, and you can also write a lattice model to show this. And then once you have a top boundary that fermion is condensed, the reduced system will always have a fermion parity symmetry. And when the bottom is this flux condensed boundary, this means a single fermion on the bottom is not condensed, then this fermion parity symmetry is preserved. So if you, after the squash, you will have this trivial superconductor. On the other hand, on the bottom, you can also stack with this P plus IP defect first, and then do the squash. then you are guaranteed to have a P plus IP superconductor. Of course, this a defect has to be coupled to the dynamical gauge field rather than naively stacking. Yeah, so in this case, so then through this construction can show that these two superconducting phase, their low entanglement excitations must also have a one-to-one correspondence. And this is because we have this like 3D operators to pump this P plus IP defect. Now, but currently, we still don't have any 2D unitary, locality preserving unitary to do the same job.
Did you have two slides? You just, you said this last bullet point, the next bullet point. Yeah, about using Hamiltonian to distinguish phases. For this P plus IP, isn't this like sort of modular commutator? Yeah, for measuring the chiral central charge, isn't that essentially using Hamiltonian terms to win that distinguish between P plus IP and trivial?
So that's a commutator of some Hamiltonian terms? Is that the case?
This a modular commutator idea for measuring chiral central charge?
I'm not very familiar with that. That's, I guess, some commutators of Hamiltonian terms and sum over or something.
Yeah.
But this process guarantees that you can also find a finite depth local unitaries to map that whatever operator you calculated to an operator in the top trivial superconductor. It may not just use the Hamiltonian terms in your superconductor, but some other terms. But it's like something that mimic the Hamiltonian local term, but still guaranteed to produce the same answer. So you will find some operators, which maybe we're not familiar with, but it will produce the same numbers.
So I think if you know the Hamiltonian, definitely knows if you are in the trivial or non-trivial SPT, right? Even in the ZQ cost ZQ case, if you know the Hamiltonian, then you definitely know whether the system is SPT, it's trivial or non-trivial SPT.
Depending on the way you know it, this locality preserving unitary means that there's an isomorphism between the terms. So if you just look at the terms, you won't know. But if you allow, say, for example, adiabatic evolution of your Hamiltonian under with respect to the symmetry, of course you can know one phase can be continuously connected to trivial product state, the other is not, and.
Like the finite depth local unitary that relates these two phases are symmetric but not symmetrically generated. That's the definition of the SPT.
Yeah. The each gate doesn't preserve the symmetry.
So I can still tell whether the Hamiltonian is trivial or not if I cannot find a symmetrically generated finite depth local unitary. I change the Hamiltonian to a trivial one.
Sorry, so again.
So if you have a Hamiltonian, and I cannot find a symmetrically generated finite depth local unitary that changes Hamiltonian to a completely trivial one, like just on site.
Right. Yeah.
Terms, then I know that this Hamiltonian is not trivial. Describe the non-trivial SPT.
Yeah, if you only allow like each terms has to be preserved the symmetry, you know there that's a way to tell.
Yeah, but your statement is that if you know the Hamiltonian, you don't know whether it's trivial.
Yeah, because this too is not contradicting.
Because the question, what's the Hamiltonian? Do you mean like the whole sum or the composition to individual terms? That is a difference.
I see. Okay. You only know this big matrix and you cannot decompose it into terms. Okay.
Even so, can you explain? So, on the left side, I have a trivial superconductor with no central charge, and then on the right-hand side, you've generated this P plus IP guy who's chiral. So it is sort of surprising that those are related with some kind of
book
or unitary.
some, because you have a 3D unit tree that can pump your P plus IP. So if you don't have a boundary, once you have a boundary, it means you are referenced to a trivial state. But if you don't have a boundary, then all the operators you allowed in the within the space, there's a one-to-one correspondence.
Okay, so you're saying that if I, right, so you're saying that, you know, because I have the bulk, this 2D system has to be on some closed manifold, and then I somehow am not sensitive to the fact that
yeah,
I
have. And any, you're, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you can compare that, yeah, trivial state and invertible state. Their excitations are have one-to-one correspondence just by using the circuits. And with that, I want to conclude with some further questions, like this can be generalized to some higher form SPTs, which we are doing. And open questions, how to include the integer quantum pulse. And this an open question, with even though recently there's some symmetry TFT construction for continuous symmetries, but I haven't checked that carefully. And then you also can talk about non-invertible defects and what's the implication for the dynamics, just you, based on those kind of excitations. With that, thank you for attention.
I asked you this a couple of days ago, but let me ask again. So suppose I very naively take an invertible state with some excitation, and then I stack that up with its inverse, but with no excitation. That should be viewed as an excitation in a trivial state. Right? So wouldn't that immediately tell me that any excitation in the invertible state automatically correspond to something in a trivial state?
Yes, that's one. Well, yeah, that direction works.
I mean, the other version works even simpler. Right? I can take my invertible state as some invertible state tensor, some trivial thing, and then I can put in some excitation in that trivial sector, in that trivial thing, and that of course counts as excitation in the invertible state. So it looks
but,
like.
But this two direction might not be one. The inverse of each other.
It tells you the map is both injective and surjective. Isn't that enough?
Yeah, but that doesn't give you a what's the that the two are not maybe not related as an inverse.
Right, it doesn't immediately construct the inverse, but I thought to show that two things are isomorphic, you only show it's both injective and surjective, right? You don't need to know immediately that they are inverse of each other.
I suppose so.
So, isn't this enough to? To see that the two should have the same, should have one-to-one correspondence in terms of excitation?
I guess you also need to include the symmetry consideration in some way, like.
But the invertibility thing takes the symmetry into account, right? I think the statement is, if you have an SPT and if you stack it up with the inverse, that is symmetrically connected to the trivial state in finite depth. So
yeah, it probably works. Yeah, but this one gives you like more, you know, yeah, you know the inverse.
Among the low entanglement defects that you mentioned, like do you also include like string nets, like insert a string net layer in some 3D phase, would that count as an excitation in this definition?
So in some trivial state, you use a circuit to generate some non-invertible state like string net?
Yeah, sorry. So you mentioned you can modify the Hamiltonian near some codimension something defect, right? So I modify my Hamiltonian on some 2D layer, and I write all of the string net terms in there. I create a string net state there. That is low entanglement, I think. So would you say that's a defect in any phase?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, yeah.
Cool.
Share their paper shows you can use circuit to generate string net states in some ambient state space.
For a given dimension, what is the there a category of the excitations in a product state? So what are the set of excitations in a trivial
product. So in through this definition, if you don't require any symmetries, Then through a trivial state, all the k-dimensional defects are those k-dimensional systems, gapped ground states. So any k-dimensional gapped ground state will be a defect in this ambient space. And previously there's talks about all defects in trivial state. I'm not sure if that's there's a precise correspondence between the two.
Would this connection between being able to turn a trivial product state into a P plus IP superconductor using some planet depth unitary, would that help us write down better Hamiltonians or things for P plus IP superconductor, given that it's difficult to write down simple models?
Yeah, actually that should be tried out, because this is a quasi-local unitary. Presumably due to the trivial, it's a quasi-local unitary that pumps the P plus IP. Presumably it does trivial things in the bulk. So you can remove those terms, and then you end up some terms only on the boundaries. So it's worth to check whether it does. But apparently it changed the chiral central charge, so there are some subtleties somewhere.
So is this quasi-local unitary just acting on the ground state to create a P plus IP superconductor on the top? Or is it really like conjugating your Hamiltonian, like affecting the whole spec? Like, is it that all you want is the ground state to have a P plus IP superconductor on the top? It would surprise me if it's like a quasi-local unitary that can conjugate your Hamiltonian such that it has a Hamiltonian with a ground state of P plus IP superconductor on the top.
So this operator is written in within the bulk of fermionic toric code, and they can conjugate on the bulk terms of the toric code, and they claim that after the conjugation, all the operators you generated still describe the same ground state.
In the sense that if I wanted to do what Naren was suggesting, to use this unitary to construct like a Hamiltonian for a P plus IP superconductor, you're just conjugating like on-site terms, right? So wouldn't that indicate that you have some commuting Hamiltonian at the top boundary?
The unitary is presuming on-site.
But it would still conjugate commuting terms to commuting terms, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some quasi local unitary. I don't know if how the tail
depends
on the boundary.
They would still commute with each other.
Yeah, the commutation, I agree. It's still commute. But it shouldn't be some commuting projector model.
So it's like exponentially localized operators that can commute each other.
I would say this is an operator. It's written in the fermionic toric code. If you literally want to write the P plus IP, you need to ungauge this defect operator, ungauge whatever, and then to write for it, to have the one that acts on the trivial bulk, and then you truncate. But this ungauging process is not trivial. That's my opinion.
What are you guaranteed in terms of locality of these conjugated like operators? You know that they're exponentially localized? Or?
You mean to once you ungauge it?
Well, so she's saying, hey, you have your unitary. Just take your, you know, Hamiltonian for your boring superconductor, and you know, conjugate each term in that Hamiltonian by your unitary, and then do you get a kind of quasi-local commuting projector Hamiltonian whose ground state is the P plus IP superconductor? I think that's my question.
What do you get just by that? You will get a fermionic toric code, the bulk is still fermionic toric codes, but the boundary is changed for, say, from some fermion condensed boundary to some other terms, and
So the point is, because it's living on a boundary, it's kind of not surprising that there's...
It's probably okay.
Yeah.
And then if you really want to get the P plus, you need to engage it.
Yeah,
Yeah, I just wonder if you would agree, or if according to your definition, if you would agree that all bulk excitations and invertible phases are just gapped phases on submanifolds.
Oh, for phases without symmetry, yes.
So this would be invertible or non-invertible, right? So I can have some sort of like quantum Hall state on a bubble in 3D.
I mean, the excitations within the quantum Hall.
No, the excitation. So suppose I have like some 3D invertible phase, and can I have a little bubble with a quantum Hall state living on the bubble? Would you call that bubble a bulk excitation?
Yeah, if you can find that bubble, but it's not guaranteed you can just have a circuit to generate that bubble. That's the hard part for integer quantum Hall.
Sure. Assuming you can't find it, you would just say that's a bulk excitation.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe another question I have is, and maybe this is what you mean by the non-invertible defects case, but when you're looking at the SIMPFTs, you would sweep an invertible defect and see how it changed the boundary. Do you know what sweeping a non-invertible defect, like a non-invertible, like a Cheshire string, and sweeping that to the boundary, how that would change the boundary conditions?
I don't think it's.
Well, you can stack it. That way we know how to do it, but sweeping, not sure.
Okay.
If it's non-invertible, the boundary might become non-symmetrical. So it does not correspond to any gap phase. Like you can consider the non-invertible, like in 2 plus auditorium, like under the E-condensed boundary. And you have, in the bulk, you can condense E particle, get a domain which is not invertible. If you fill that domain wall with the e-condensed boundary, you get two times e-condensed boundary, which is not, it's not symmetrical.
Yeah.
So maybe a related question, what kind of stuff can you, which of the Lagrangian algebras can you relate by this kind of sweeping stuff? And if, let's say I give you some modular tensor category, I give you all of the Lagrangian algebras, which of the boundaries are not distinguishable?
Those related by symmetries, it corresponds to some invertible defects.
So would you say all of the condensation defects give you those?
Condensation defects, I'm not sure. I didn't go through all of them.
The invertible condensation. I think all of the invertible zero-form symmetries are probably condensation defects.
If you can all write all say any unchanged symmetries in terms of condensation defects, then yes.
Ah, I see. But any unchanged symmetry E and M are also interchanged by any.
Yeah.
So
they are relatively distinct.
But I think there's like QI quantities that you can compute that distinguish E and M, and that's not there. Like there are these entanglement entropy constructions by I think Isaac and Kamin collaborators that distinguish rough and smooth boundaries.
For 2D or
3D? Any D. I know the 3D one. 3 plus 1D. I'm pretty sure 2 plus 1D would be easier. I think you can compute those things.
No, the claim is like the common thing you compute in one trivial system and another, like E condensed one, M condensed one, they have the same physical interpretation. They might distinguish. But the claim is that you can also find another sum operator that you're not familiar with. That corresponds to you, say, unfamiliar operators in E condensed one to a familiar operators in M condensed one. These two give you the same results.
So we have lots of time for discussion this afternoon. How about we call it here and you have to ask everyone questions?